From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week when the 2020 director of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign sat down with the New York Times to answer a question. Would Bernie have won? They were talking about 2024, but also 2020 and 2016. In the end, Faiz Shakir says it's more important to answer the question, what made Bernie Sanders a figure of passion among voters, and what do the parties need to learn from that? What is clear is that President Biden was on track to lose an actual landslide, something more like 2008. Shakir says some of that was inflation, which hammered incumbent politicians worldwide. But Shakir says it is more than that. He says voters know when a politician feels an issue in their bones. And what, he wondered, did voters think that Kamala Harris felt in her bones? What issue was a burning point of passion for her? David Plouffe is a former Obama team strategist who was brought on to try to help Vice President Harris climb out of that massive hole left by President Biden. Today, Plouffe says this about the reality now facing Democrats going forward. Quote, "The math is the math. There are a lot more non-college voters than there are college voters in most states. The math doesn't work for the Democrats to win national elections, particularly in higher turnout elections, if you lose much more of the non-college vote, whether it be white, black, brown, or Asian," end quote. Tyler Austin Harper is a political commentator and a writer who says Democrats must now understand that pushing Bernie Sanders aside for mainstream Democrats has been a disaster. He wants a Democratic Party that will be ruthless in taking on big money and corporate power, but he says the Democrats are so entrenched in their relationships with Wall Street, big corporations, big donors, that they might just double down and become the party of the elite educated class only. And here, Harper keys in on what he thinks is a misperception about the right-left paradigm in this country. Harper writes that American voters now don't really think about the ideas of Bernie Sanders as being extreme left. They think he's populist. They think about the ideas of Kamala Harris as being far left, fairly or not. He's talking about Harris's position on social issues like trans issues or introducing herself at public events and announcing her pronouns. And he writes, quote, "The public clearly associates the left not with economic populism, but with progressive cultural views. And they are put off by the left's cultural views and what they perceive as wokeness," end quote. Meanwhile, Sanders' populist economic views are being adopted by some on the right, sometimes cynically for political gain, but adopted nonetheless. Peter Roth is a Democratic strategist who says the party should throw out the people who decided that Clinton and Biden were better candidates than Bernie Sanders. He writes that the Democratic establishment missed a chance to create a passionate movement focused on helping working people. And he adds the following, quote, "Democrats must invest in the talented young male voices that currently occupy their ranks, and then they need to expand the heck out of that bench. The gender gap is now too severe to ignore. Candidates with experience in the armed services, professional sports, manufacturing, and farming should be brought to the fore. The world of union organizing is packed with men who are effective communicators. Find them," end quote. So what next? Bernie Sanders himself is 83, probably not running for president again. Although who knows what the age of presidents these days. But Harper mused about that the next Democratic candidate has to be comfortable attending the Mike Tyson-Jake Paul fight. Maybe that's Gretchen Whitmer or John Fetterman or Andy Beshear. Maybe that's too reductive a way to look at it. Sanders simply says that his Democratic colleagues are too dismissive of young American men who flocked to Donald Trump in droves. Give them something to be excited about, Sanders says. Stop mocking them as uneducated or unworthy of attention. Our guest this hour would have loved to see Senator Sanders become a President Sanders sometime over the past 8 years. And we're going to talk about what they want to see in the future. Let me welcome them now. Kelly Cheadle is an artist and community organizer. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's great to be here.
And welcome as well to Abigail McHugh Griffith. Abby is a former Sanders supporter, organizer? I don't know.
Enthusiastic volunteer.
Enthusiastic volunteer back in the day now, I guess, almost a decade ago. I appreciate you both being here. And you know, you heard a lot of diagnoses there, but I think it's valuable to hear what Bernie Sanders himself says, some of what he says. And he was talking to the New York Times recently, about a week after the election, and he said, boy, there's a lot of hand-wringing that if Kamala Harris had just gone on Joe Rogan, she could have won this campaign. And what you're going to hear him say is, yes, but it's more than where you go. It's what you're saying. Let's listen.
There is a new world of media out there. And it's not just NBC, CBS, or the New York Times. It is podcasts. It is Joe Rogan. It is Fox News. It is young people who nobody in the Democratic leadership has ever heard of who have YouTube programmers that attract millions of people. That is the reality. Can you ignore that? That is insane. Anyone who thinks you could ignore that reality is crazy. Mm-hmm. In my experience, not that I've been on millions of these shows, the people that I talk to treat me with respect. And I think you cannot be, you know, oh, Joe Rogan said this or he says that. Yeah, so what? You know, my wife disagrees with me on this or that issue. So what? You can't run away from somebody because they may have said something stupid or something that you disagree with. That's life.
Hmm.
But most importantly, when you go on the show, what do you say? So Joe Rogan asked you, what do you think about the fact that we have more income and wealth inequality than ever before? Oh, well, yeah, I don't know. I can't answer that question. What do you think about the fact that we're the only major country not to guarantee health care? Well, gee, I'd like to not talk about that, but I don't want to offend the insurance companies. Why are we paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs? Well, I can't talk about that because, you know, I get money from the pharma. That's the problem. So, yeah, you got to go on different outlets. Of course you do. But most importantly, you got to know what you believe and what you're prepared to fight for and what your vision for the future of this country is.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders talking to the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago. Abigail McHugh Griffith, what do you make of what you just heard from him there?
It does still resonate with me, for sure. You know, and I so deeply appreciate it, just his willingness to say true things that maybe are uncomfortable to hear.
What did you hear there, Kelly?
Oh, my heart just did like a little sigh of, you know, what we could have had. Someone who's willing to say, you know what? Maybe it's not a great thing that we have so much money driving the conversation. Maybe we need to talk to people as human beings and all their complexities and all of their conundrums and reach out and find places where we can make connections and make a path forward together, even if it's awkward.
Can I ask both of you, having done some work, being enthusiastic volunteers and wanting in past elections to see a candidate and a President Sanders, Kelly, is it your view, especially 2020, but 2016 to an extent, is it your view that the Democratic establishment really is the reason Bernie Sanders was never at the top of the ticket, or did his momentum peter out as campaigns went on and, you know, because he didn't win the majority of the delegates. He wasn't forced aside after winning a nomination. But I think it's a question of whether you think he was really kind of railroaded out by the establishment.
I think you could, you know, I remember watching this in real time and seeing sort of the horse trading that was going on. You had a very busy field and then suddenly you didn't. So it was one thing to, you know, when you're running against six or seven people, to start to build that momentum.
Especially 2020, I think.
I'm thinking 2016 in particular, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And just seeing what happens, you know, when one person steps out and then lends their support to a presumed front runner, or at least the preferred front runner, you know, it you get piled on at a certain point, and that momentum gets slowed down.
What did you see, Abby?
You know, I think back really on the way that labels, and specifically the label of socialist, I think took the headlines and got in the way of some of the real message, and the message that was indeed resonating with people. But that kind of backlash that we did see from the, you know, Democratic establishment, you know, I'm not savvy enough, you know, to really understand the political landscape in a deep way to, you know, be able to critique this, you know, with any degree of authority. But I even recall for myself, you know, I don't identify as a Democratic Socialist specifically, but I remember then and now still feeling the burden of that label and not wanting to be identified and siloed in that way. So to me, that was an important factor in the campaign.
Not, I don't think what you're saying, not because you're uncomfortable with what Sanders wanted to do,
not
his
at
policies.
All. Not at all, yes.
But because of the political reality of having the word, even a Democratic Socialist,
right,
on your label.
Right, and the judgment associated with the label without necessarily a deeper understanding of what it meant, and what the policies were that would align with it, but just the
branding problem.
Branding problem, yeah. Exactly.
You see it as a branding problem, Kelly?
Oh God, branding! Like this is what kills me is that like we're making these fundamental choices based on branding. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is what
I hear
happens.
Abby trying to be pragmatic here and right. saying she wanted Bernie Sanders to be president more than anything, probably. But
the reality is we are influenced by branding. Like every single day, the drinks that you drink, the car that you drive, the air that you breathe, even to a certain extent, is influenced by branding because of the money that is behind the companies that are trying to get you to buy their things. This whole capitalist society that we live in, branding is the bread and butter of capitalism, and they need those elected officials to work in their favor to get more money.
So when you look at now what Bernie Sanders is saying about how voters respond to candidates, Bernie Sanders agreed with the idea that whether you like Donald Trump or not, people feel like he is – I'm going to use the word authentic, and he doesn't mean honest. He doesn't mean that people think that Donald Trump is always honest. But Donald Trump talks about immigration – people feel like, yep, that is definitely what he thinks. He wants to deport 11 to 20 million people. And he's got all kinds of – when he says we need more immigrants from Norway and not from the blank hole countries, that's authentic. And that at
it's
least –
it's also racist.
I'm not debating at all.
That, for sure,
like,
for sure.
To me, that's like textbook definition of racism. But what he's saying is what has resonated with voters is this is not a focus grouped candidate. That candidate, for all his flaws, is himself. And – in that New York Times interview, he never said Kamala Harris wasn't a passionate candidate, but he definitely implied it. What he's saying is, look at what voters were observing. What issue is in your bones? What fires you? Abby, did you see in Vice President Harris a person who is driven every day by issues that she could speak for hours on and is passionate? Whether it's – and again, it can't be every issue. Nobody's passionate about every single issue up and down the table, but – you know, Bernie Sanders is pretty easy to figure out what he's fired up by. Did you see similar issues that Harris is fired up by in a similar way?
Well, you know, I do think there was a lot to like about Harris as a candidate and some of what's played out post-election of, you know, kind of throwing her under the bus and her candidacy under the bus, you know, whatever, has maybe not been entirely helpful. But when I think about the issues I'm passionate about and whether I was hearing Harris really talk strongly about that in ways that I found compelling, I mean, I think the answer is mostly no. You know, and of course, I'm thinking specifically about climate change here, where one of the things that I loved about Bernie way back in 2016 is he was naming this as a real problem that needed to be addressed urgently. And we have seen candidates back away from that, and it was barely mentioned in this election cycle. So to me, that is a problem when you have candidates who are tiptoeing around real important issues that do matter to voters. It's hard to know what they really stand for and what they believe.
Yeah, I mean, so on climate related to that is the issue of fracking. Mm-hmm. And we know that in mm-hmm. 2019, when Kamala Harris ran for president, she had talked about a ban on fracking. She was very quick to disavow that in this cycle, but clearly didn't want to talk about it. When CNN brought it up, she gave about a 30-word answer and was like, let's move on here. And then it was like, well, my values haven't changed. But just my position on this has changed. But if you don't want to talk about something, I think it's a signal to voters that you're uncomfortable. And then you start wondering, well, why is this person not able to speak at length? What's going here? You want to jump in here, Kelly?
You know, I when I think about the Harris campaign, I feel like I didn't get to hear enough from her. You know, the moments that we saw of her online or the moments that we saw of her on TV were limited. We didn't get the, I think because of the cycle, the way that it was such a last minute switch, you didn't have the opportunity to hear from her what moved her enough. And then what happened?
Did you feel like there's issues that really drive her every day that animate her?
I would have loved to hear more about them.
Okay.
You know, it's hard because I think there was such an effort to make sure that like there were no missteps, that it kind of sucked the humanity out of her campaign. Like everything was glossy, everything was fabulous because there was so much money poured into it. But like, I don't want to hear from Lady Gaga. I want to hear from Kamala Harris about how she feels about different things and what moves her.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that she was between a rock and a hard place.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, it was kind of, from a messaging standpoint, lose-lose for her. Like, I understand why she didn't want to talk about fracking. I understand why she didn't want to talk about climate change. But that doesn't help me as a voter to feel passionate about her and her campaign, and to just have that same level of enthusiasm and excitement that I really genuinely experienced around Bernie.
Maybe this is just me saying this from the safety of a studio microphone and not being a presidential candidate, which I will never be, thank goodness for the country and for me. But I guess the way I looked at some of those comments, just take fracking as an issue. If she would have come out and said, look, eventually we're going to need to be off. We're going to be on clean energy almost entirely. Sooner the better. And one of my biggest goals is getting us there as fast as we can. I also know the reality that right now we've got a very fragmented, very fraught, divided country. And people are worried about their jobs. People are worried about economic insecurity. If you're in rural Pennsylvania, in northern Pennsylvania, you're worried about that. And right now, I'm going to move back from this position. And it's not because I just want to win Pennsylvania, although I do.
Okay, so in what world does she get a soundbite that's that long?
I know, I know. But here's where I'm trying to reset my ideas about that. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of long sound bites that are making the rounds through podcasts and new media. And maybe you get points for being more authentic. Maybe if she says, like, look, for now, this is the pragmatic thing to do. It is not where I want to be long term. If you're in Pennsylvania, in my term, you're not going to lose your chance to frack. I do think eventually we need to find other work for you. But I'm not going to do that until you feel like we care about making sure that you do have a soft landing. We're not just going to say no fracking tomorrow. No jobs for the frackers. Good luck to all you guys. See ya. Communicate in a way that says, no, those are real human beings. And if you work in fracking, you're not a bad person. If you work in coal in West Virginia or Kentucky, you're not a bad person. We just need to work on finding different things for all of us to be able to make a living on that doesn't impact our kids' future. And we're going to get there eventually. Maybe not today. We got to be step by step. If she says that, that sounds authentic to me.
It does. And it would have been great if we had had the opportunity to hear that. But, you know, with the media landscape being what it is and seeing how, you know, there's one or two corporations that own media outlets in every area of the country, not getting the opportunity to have, you know, a view of these candidates in a localized context, like, the DNC used to have how many reporters? Used to have, I mean, I remember growing up, there was a morning paper and there was an afternoon paper.
Yeah.
And I was just looking at mayoral reviews in the DNC from like 20 years ago. And there were panels and panels of discussions about where they sat on matters, what they thought about things. And we don't have that anymore. So, you know, it's great that we have these podcasts and we have these different things, but it's not like, you know, Kamala Harris could come to Rochester and have an interview with the DNC. She would have to find, you know, this podcaster to reach this segment of people and this pod, you know, like the diffusion of information is wonderful and horrible all at the same time. But really the loss of those anchors in the community is hurting us.
I think there's definitely something there. I also think that there is, having worked in West Virginia, I started my career and reported on the coal industry for a couple of years in West Virginia, and that was illuminating for a 20-something me. You know, I was in a helicopter flying above coal slurry impoundment lakes, you know, and digging through DEP documents and, you know, which were written by the coal industry, the Department of Environmental Protection. And, you know, as a 24-year-old, it was wild. And one of the things that I remember about that experience is that from a faraway vantage point, from the view of Washington or maybe the national media, it's like, well, West Virginia loves the coal industry, history, mining, et cetera. And on the broad strokes, that's true. But if you live in West Virginia, you don't love the coal barons who have literal massive mansions on the mountaintops that they take helicopters to and from just to get around, while the miners don't get paid well, don't get good health insurance, sometimes die in accidents, have all kinds of issues breathing. Mm-hmm. So it's more complicated than that. And I feel like, you know, if I'm going to make the case, which I'm not, I'm just trying to explore this, but if I'm going to make the case that Senator Bernie Sanders has something to say about this that the Democratic Party didn't, I would say that he gets the distinction that if you just come in and be like, well, coal mining bad, good luck, or fracking bad, good luck. If you make that like that moral question. But if you say like, listen, you've been exploited here. There are people getting rich off your backs. And meanwhile, some of you are getting sick and you don't even have insurance. That's a different deal. He talks about that in a way that I don't often hear other politicians talking, if that makes sense.
I think part of the challenge, too, is that, like, I think we've kind of flip-flopped this whole selecting our leaders concept. Like, people shouldn't just be kind of dropped down upon us like, oh, here is your new leader. They should be coming from the ranks. They should be coming up from below. Like, these are people who we have built trust with, who have worked with us, who have, you know, have heard us and can amplify our voices. It shouldn't just be like, oh, yeah, here's this guy or this guy.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment, because part of what Kelly's talking about is how candidates even get on ballots, how parties select them. And one of the big realities facing Democrats, if you're a Democrat right now, is a lot of the divides narrowed a bit in this election, and the one that widened is the educational divide. So, you know, when Tyler Austin Harper says the Democrats are very much in danger of becoming just the party of the educated elite, that's a dangerous place to be. The management class, as Tyler Austin Harper says. You don't want to just be the party of the management class. You're going to lose every election if that is the case. And so we'll talk in a moment about whether our guests agree with those critiques. But how do you see this question on the distinction on issues like climate, but also economics blended in? Is that something you think political leaders can pull off effectively?
Well, I think what you're getting is these are not simple conversations. If they're reduced to sound bites, we are missing the point. So where are those spaces for exploring complexity and nuance and the fact that, yes, these just like good and evil, or, you know, the binary narratives are not serving us well. And to the extent that politicians are talking down to donors, framing things in those terms, of course they're going to lose support and not, you know, reach people with what they know in their hearts to be true.
So one brief question before I get to phone calls and emails, of which we'll have plenty. And listeners, if you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. We're talking to Abigail McCube Griffa and Kelly Cheadle, who have spent some time volunteering and trying to work in the past to elect Senator Bernie Sanders when he was running for president. Obviously, it didn't work out in that way, but there's been a lot of sort of Monday morning quarterbacking since the election and a lot of conversations about what happened and what went wrong. We thought it'd be interesting, as the New York Times asked, would Bernie have won, not to ask that question, but to ask, what are the lessons that you see here? It's not like an I told you so, but it's kind of a, what are you seeing here? And so I do wonder, Abby, when you think about voters who vote in ways that you personally find like, I can't relate to this, how do you not get to a point where you would call them, and then Kelly, before the hour, Kelly brought up the deplorables comment in 2016. That's fair.
The basket of deplorables.
How do you get a point? How do you resist feeling and saying and just sort of condemning that way? And how do you stay open to making sure bridges can be built?
So the real message that I'm taking away from this election is that people recognize that the status quo is not working and we need change. And I fully agree with, you know, that, you know, people may have made a different decision at the polls than I did based on that understanding. But I do completely agree that we can't just continue to pretend like the economy is serving us well and that politicians are looking out for our best interests. So that desire for change, that desire to shake things up, I share it, and I look forward to kind of connecting with people, working with people over these next 4 years to make sure that we have better options in, what is it, 2028? Is that what year we'll be looking at?
Yeah. How about you, Kelly?
Well, I think I just want to underscore that whole idea of working with people for the next 4 years. Like, you can't just show up every 4 years and be like, hey, vote for my guy. Like, that doesn't work. People need to see their lives materially improve to know that your guy or your gal or your person is the one for them. If you're only showing up, you know, asking for a donation every 20 minutes on your phone when you need, if you're only showing up when you need something and you're not listening to me, and I am telling you clearly that my community is in pain, my community needs A, B, C, D, X, Y, and Z, and you're saying to me that, like, well, Wall Street's doing great, it means you're not listening. And we need you to listen. And if you're not going to listen, you know, there are going to be folks that are going to stay home, and there are going to be folks that are ticked off and, you know, who are afraid. And if someone gives them an easy answer, they might take it. And that, I think, is what happened.
So your framing of if you only show up every 4 years, it's similar to if people think about friends or ostensible friends. But if you've got friends who only reach out when they need something.
Are they really a friend?
Are they really a friend? And you're saying voters figure that out about political parties, campaigns.
I mean, this is supposed to be public service. I mean, this is supposed to be kind of a really boring bureaucratic job.
Hard work.
Where you make sure that, you know, like, you allocate funds to the right buckets to make sure that those bigger issues, you know, at the federal level, things that we might be more difficult to do, you know, in smaller groups, get done on the national level. It doesn't change what is needed, you know, on the ground. You have, like, the thought leader pointing in the general direction, but really what happens locally. So, you know, I was really looking forward to, you know, the potential for lots of federal funding for housing coming to Rochester. And now I'm kind of looking around going, well, I guess we're going to have to come up with some other solution because that money's not coming from the Fed in the next 4 years. And what does that mean?
All right. Let me get some feedback here. A lot of different directions we can go here. John and Bob, I'll take your calls first. John in Irondequoit. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Evan. How you doing?
Good.
Just a couple of quick comments. I tuned in late, but I caught the bit about Kamala Harris didn't have enough time to lay out her case and explain things in any detail. And I kind of disagree with that. I saw her on TV and doing interviews and things lots of times. And of course, she spent a lot of time with the convention and she seemed to spend a lot of time, you know, smiling and waving at all her supporters. She kind of wore out the phrase, we need to turn the page, but she never read from that page and explained to us what was on that page. At the debate, I think she did a fairly good job at calling Trump out on certain things, but I was really disappointed. I didn't see that tough, seasoned prosecutor, you know, taking him to task on anything. And that's really the kind of, thing I wanted to see more from her, is that confidence. Some of the comments you made a lot of sense. And to me, yes, she needs to explain to people that, look, we're not just going to flip a switch. Things need to take time. And we're on your side. And here's what we're going to do that's going to help you in the long run. And I just didn't see a lot of that from her campaign, and I was disappointed.
John, thank you. Kelly, what do you make of that?
Yes, and I think because of this diversified media landscape, all of us had different experiences with what we were able to see. I mean, there was a report that there were spikes for Google searches on Election Day for did Joe Biden drop out in key areas that, like, should have been areas of focus for the campaign. So if we're not reaching people and they don't realize that Joe Biden wasn't still running on Election Day, you know, of course they didn't get to hear what she had to say. They didn't even know she was the one that was on the top of the ticket. So it's
I think a
challenge.
Part of what John is saying is when she had those opportunities, mm-hmm. she didn't make an effective enough case.
I mean, she had 3 months, I think, to put together a campaign, and was probably very much, I don't want to say controlled, because that implies that she didn't have her own ability to make decisions. But I think at that point, when you are in a situation where you are running the campaign of your life and you have lots of people around you who have experience or authority, and you want this job, and you are doing, I mean, campaigning itself is bonkers. So you want to surround yourself with people that you trust. And even those folks just kind of showed up for her. At the she didn't have time to kind of build and learn who was really on her side, who was worth their salt. So I think, you know, for the time that she had, I think she did a great job. It would have been great to have given her longer time to kind of meet the community, meet the people.
There should have been a campaign the year before.
Oh, Joe, I mean, Biden, like, there's a whole other show.
Yeah, it would have been a different story altogether. Go ahead, Abby. What do you make of John's call?
Yeah, I agree with Kelly about kind of these separate parallel universes from a media perspective that we're living in. Certainly impacts it. Also, it strikes me that John, it sounds to me like, is a proactive seeker of information. And I don't think that all voters necessarily are. And with the limited time Harris did, again, I think she did her darndest to get her message out there. Skimpy on details at times, as we've already discussed. But, you know, a lot of things could have, should have played out differently. I wish they had. And at this point, you know, it's about what can we learn from this, and how can we do better in the future?
Yeah, it's definitely true that not all voters are political junkies, and they're not all addicted to every aspect of campaign. Some people are very, very busy. Some are working three jobs. Some do not really like politics. Some will check in right before they have to vote, if they're going to vote at all. And, you know, I've been thinking about that in the last 48 hours, thinking about this Hunter Biden pardon, because for sure there will be ads in a couple years where Republicans put in an ad and say, you know, you keep hearing from Democrats that Donald Trump and the Republicans are dangerous. And it's a clip of Biden and others saying, you know, they don't respect the rule of law. You know, they're going to destroy the democracy.
How many felonies does he have?
No, I know.
I'm just saying.
Republicans are going to say.
They're going to say what they're going to say anyway.
No, but what I'm saying is for the low attention, the voters who are not all that engaged, all they're going to hear is those sound bites of Biden going, well, you know, I'm never going to pardon my own son. I wouldn't do that. His press secretary saying he's made it clear he's not going to do it. Biden saying Trump's the threat to the rule of law. Cut to a newscaster saying Trump's pardoning Biden. And then say, you know, then the Republicans' ad's going to say, when Democrats say that you can't trust Republicans, they're talking about themselves. And if you check in a week before the election and you don't really pay attention otherwise, or you don't have time to, you're going to be very impacted by that.
Well, I think this probably speaks to the need for civic engagement beyond election season.
Well, I don't disagree. I'm just saying, like, I feel like when it comes to some of the things that we've seen recently, part of what Kelly's point matters. Kelly's point is you don't just show up when you need something. You don't just show up every 4 years. People will remember. Well, things that are happening right now will be remembered in 2 and 4 years. And if you tell people that only one side is not interested in the rule of law or interested in nepotism and blah, 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 get ready for those ads. Get ready on the other side of it, because, you know, not everybody's like John, who just called. You're right about that. Bob and Webster. Hello, Bob. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a little statement here. It has four or five items that Democrats failed to attack the Republicans on. So the Democrats don't need to change. They need to change what they focus on. We are against big and hidden money in politics. The Republicans selected a Supreme Court that rubber stamped Citizens United and put big business and billionaires into the power instead of you and I. Democrats and only six Republicans passed the infrastructure bill to rebuild our bridges, roads, much less our getting lead out of our drinking water pipes, so kids aren't nut jobs and are unable to learn and behave. The Republicans were against the infrastructure bill. Congressman Chip Roy of Texas Republican, stood on the House floor shouting at his fellow Republicans that he could not go back to his district and say one thing, not one thing, that he or they did for his constituents or our country. Not one thing.
All right, I got to jump in, Bob, because I just want to make sure that, you know, we've got time for everybody. I do appreciate the phone call. That last point is true. I've seen the bite of Congressman Roy. I'm not a partisan, and I'm not here to argue how campaigns should be run. I'm trying to understand how people are thinking through the implications here. It is definitely true that a lot of Republicans thought they were going to lose and that they hadn't done much with a lot of power. And, well, turns out that almost every American county moved to the right, and the biggest rightward shifts were in cities. Now, that it's not because people who voted left before voted right. A lot of people didn't vote. Big chunks of voters, blue voters, stayed home. But still, it was a rightward shift in American cities. So I hear you that you don't really buy the idea that Democrats have to change that much. They have to maybe market better. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know if our guest in studio, Bernie Sanders, does not think Democrats just have to explain better what they've done. He's saying they have to change their priorities. What do you see, Kelly?
I think that, I know this sounds strange to be using the word trust and politician in the same sentence. Maybe trust and public servant go together better. It takes a long time to build trust. You have to have a legacy of action, and you have to deliver. Trust is hard won. It is easily lost. So when our public servants don't deliver for us, or they say one thing and they do another, that's a ding. And you've got to have to fight against it. And I hate the politicization of, you know, something, again, that is really supposed to be just making it possible for us to live a good life. I mean, at least in the ideal sense, you could argue that, you know, like the system works the way the system does work, and it's designed to consolidate power and money. And yes, for sure, there's that argument. But I think, you know, from an idealistic standpoint, I'd like to think that, like, we come together in cities and towns and states and pool our funds together to do the bigger things that we can't do as individuals. And I hope it's possible for us to get back to that. I know that sounds kind of corny, old-fashioned, but, like, I just want things to work. I want to be able to, like, relax with my family. I want to be able to make art. I don't want to have to fight so hard.
Abby, you're nodding over there.
Yes. So, thank you just for articulating that, Kelly. That really resonates with me. And, you know, Bob, I think, pointed out that Democrats have indeed done some really good, important things that we can and should celebrate. But the words that Bob used that I guess rub me a little the wrong way is that they need to do a better job of attacking Republicans. And that, to me, I don't know, like, this vicious cycle of just attack, attack, attack. And I think it becomes not just about calling out the politicians for what they might be doing that is harmful, but it ends up villainizing people who, again, are just trying to live their lives and get by and provide for their families. So I am wondering how we break out of that and talk to each other again, like, as human beings, with respect, with appreciation for each other's needs and values and differences, right?
What happened to good sportsmanship?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
like, right. you can be on opposite sides of something and not want to, like, see someone harmed. Like, it feels like we've gone from opponent to
enemy.
Yeah. Like, that's
villain.
That's scary. Like, that is, that,
and the Democrats
sit right
are
me.
Doing that too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we point at the Republicans for some of the spreading of hate and fear and violence, which, you know, is really happening. But I wonder to what extent Democrats also then reinforce that.
Well, so our guests in the studio have a different prescription than Peter Roth, who said start by firing every consultant who wanted Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders. And
you can fire them nicely. I'm not objecting to that.
Then he says, the Obama coalition is dead, and so too are the niceties and mores of the Obama era. There is one solution to this reality, but I can offer a few prescriptions. Democrats need to get mean, nasty.
No.
Fundamental rules of political discourse have changed, and we must adapt to them.
No, thank you.
Nope.
No?
No. Honestly, the thing that we lost, Obama was a community organizer. That campaign was a fantastic model of how to get people engaged and moving together. I mean, same thing with the Sanders campaign. But then the problem was that they shut off that connection. As soon as Obama was in office, that connection to community was just cut off. And what a different world we would be living in if those folks were still connected to each other and still working together. Because, like, our elected officials are supposed to be conduits for community power. They're not supposed to be exerting their own power on everybody else.
Okay, so getting mean, getting nasty, mirroring the right, you're saying no.
No.
Okay.
Life's too short.
Our guests don't want to do that. Now, how about the idea that you've got to elect more people from the union movement, more farmers, more working class people without higher ed degrees?
I think democracy works better when it reflects the people. So if those folks are not included at the table, they absolutely should be at the table.
More young men specifically. Is there a gender gap problem?
Have you done any work in union organizing? The union organizers who get the most stuff done are typically black women. So bring them on. I would love to see more black women in politics.
Yeah, and I think the diversity representation, again, being able to respectfully communicate with each other and understand the varying different challenges that different groups and individuals are dealing with. So it doesn't become like this group, this zero-sum scarcity mindset thing. We got to get beyond that. It's bringing us all down.
All right. Back we go to your phone calls. Frank in Greece is next. Hello, Frank. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I keep hearing a great deal about candidates and about consultants. I'm afraid this is unpopular, and you can cut me off if you want, but I blame the voters. I think the voters fell for racist tropes. I think they fell for foolishness about how their personal incomes would improve if they voted a certain way. I believe they chose oversimplified solutions. I think they chose violence. And I think we're going to get everything we asked for.
Well, Frank, I know a lot of people on the political left do feel that way. I understand that people feel that way. And I'll let our guests respond. I can tell you that this doesn't mean that there's not racism that comes from leaders. And Donald Trump has done things that are sort of textbook racism, as we've talked about, at times. But it is important to understand what the electorate did. There are two major gaps right now. I mean, there's racial gaps, of course. But the racial gaps got smaller in this election. Donald Trump won Latino men outright. He won young men, 18 to 29, of all backgrounds. The African-American vote got a little narrower. I mean, still a landslide for the Democrat in this race. But Trump got more of it, and particularly much better with men of color. Of all backgrounds. So the racial gap narrowed a bit. And instead, what grew was the class gap, educational income. That got wider. And then there's a gender gap that remains pretty big. That's part of the reality of the electorate. That doesn't invalidate anybody's claims about this politician or that. I'm just observing what happened. Did that surprise you, by the way, Kelly Cheadle, that some of the racial gap actually narrowed and it was a class gap that got bigger?
I didn't analyze any of the results from that piece. I think I was more focused on what happens next. You know, what do we need to do as a local community to kind of deal with a Donald Trump presidency 2.0? You know, somebody else can go through and analyze the data and pull whatever.
You're focused, as you said, things like housing.
Housing.
How to fund, what to do.
You know, like, I think you know, as we look at this conversation about, like, coulda, shoulda had Bernie, it's not necessarily about Bernie. It's about a blueprint for the future. Like, what are the plans that we are making for ourselves? Like, yeah, this guy might have the job for the next 4 years, but, like, we're the ones that are going to live here. So what do we need to do as a community to make sure that people have housing for all, that people have health care for all, that people have what they need to live a good life? And that's what I'm focused on.
Abby is someone who's thought a lot about what parents are dealing with when it comes to issues like climate, but also, you know, raising boys and young men. Do you look at some of those gaps in the electorate? Do you think about young men who are, you know, voting pretty hard to the right now and think about what that portends and what to do about it?
I think about young men all the time, specifically because, you know, with two sons, two brothers, mm-hmm. a husband, lots of other men in my life who I love, and I see how men are struggling, right? And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, right? We cannot, like, simplify this down to a single issue. I think Kelly is right to bring us back to the issues themselves and the policies that would advance progress on the issues that voters really care about. You know, Frank's point that we should blame the voters, of course, I find problematic because I think we need to think about what influences the voters. And I would bring that back to money in politics and all the various different ways that, again, we can just think about our economic system drives people to pursue activities, products, whatever, that are harming us and deepening the divisions. So, I hope over these next 4 years we can really kind of think structurally about the challenges we're facing and not be pointing the finger at any individual humans. We all have our shortcomings. We all make pretty dumb decisions on the regular. But what are the systems that shape those decisions and constrain our choices?
What I hear you saying is that don't oversimplify complex problems.
Mm-hmm.
Don't look at 18 to 29-year-old men and be like, they're irredeemable.
Oh gosh,
oh,
no.
God, no.
You know,
no, they're lost.
But also don't say it's one thing or it's this or
right,
it's that.
Right.
It's complex.
Mm-hmm.
But don't give up on working on the problem. So as we, I'm going to grab one more phone call and I'm going to ask our guests what they really do hope is learned and addressed going forward, because probably 83-year-old Bernie Sanders probably isn't running again. But let me grab that call from Elena in Webster. Hello, Elena. Go ahead.
Hi. My recent question was about Bernie Sanders' recent maneuvering to work with Elon Musk and the new Doge agency in order to cut the Pentagon funding.
Yeah, what are you wondering?
Is he kind of doing this as a maneuvering to essentially call the Republicans bluff? Or do you think that the Republicans are actually going to follow through on this?
Yeah, so it's a fair question. And Sanders addressed some of that with the New York Times interview. So I'll just tell you what he said, because he talked also about working with Trump on credit cards, capping credit card interest rates at 10%, which is something Trump has said. And Bernie Sanders said, I don't have to like you. I don't have to like your policies. I didn't have to have voted for you, but I will work with you on individual policies if they're good. So on credit cards, he's going to work with the Trump administration and try to get that 10% cap. That could happen. We'll see how serious the administration is. On DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, named after an altcoin, because that's the world we're in. Sanders has said he's not a big fan of Elon Musk, but he wants to cut the Pentagon budget. And if they want his help, he'll work with them. So I don't think it's more complicated than that, Elena. I don't know. But, I mean, our guests maybe know Bernie Sanders better than I do. What do you think, Kelly Cheadle?
I think he is a lifelong savvy strategist. And he, you know, these are the cards that he's been dealt. He's going to play the best hand he can.
And that's what we all need to do, right? We are in the position we are in. Looking back and wishing we'd done things differently, well, you know, we can learn lessons. But it only serves us up to a point. So where do we go from now here? What is strategic? What is pragmatic? I'm willing to work with people who I don't entirely agree with, too. Sure, why not?
All right. So about a minute apiece here as we close here. Kelly Cheadle, when you think looking forward here, one of the most important lessons you want to be learned from what Senator Sanders brought to politics, what we learned from this election, and what could be done next, what do you want that to be?
I think the lesson is that, you know, this is not about just Bernie. The ideas that he highlighted really sparked a movement. And, you know, while he may not have been elected, the energy that he created did not go away. So it's our responsibility to kind of like take the message, to recognize that, you know, housing is probably the next civil rights battle that we're going to have to fight to make sure that people are able to stay in their homes and survive and thrive, which is wild that we have to fight for that, but that's where we are. So it's up to us to carry forward and ensure that we don't just wallow, but we take action and we work together.
Abby?
I think it's time to move away from name-calling and finger-pointing to recognize our interdependence, right? We got some major problems. The only way we're going to get through this is together, so we need to figure out how to collaborate and find common ground. And focusing here locally. You know, there's a lot of work we can do in our local community, and so it's time for us all to step up and just dig in.
Yeah, we're all in this together, whether we want to or not.
Yep.
A listener asked if the guests think that there is a Sanders 2.0. It's too early for that. We just got through one presidential campaign. Are there people who you look at and say, boy, you know, they could have many, many interesting ideas going forward? I really want to hear more from them.
You know, I want to hear more from everybody. I don't think it's about any individual person. It's not about one person taking on the mantle of everything. It's about everybody contributing something.
Ditto.
Okay. I want to thank our guests for being here. Listeners, if we didn't get your emails or calls, we've got a lot more to say on a lot of these issues individually. I mean, really a lot of wise words from our guests about not oversimplifying and understanding the challenge ahead, not packaging something into a single soundbite. We're going to try to keep doing that. But I want to thank Kelly Cheadle, who is an artist and community organizer and a longtime supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders. Still is today.
Still a fan.
Still a fan. Thank you for being here, Kelly.
Thanks.
Abigail McHugh Griffa is a former Sanders volunteer and still an enthusiastic admirer. But thank you for being here and sharing your thoughts as well.
Thanks so much for having us.
More connections coming up in a moment.